You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, July 12, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and I'm Michael Monday. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. On today's program, Derek Davidson, journalist, foreign policy analyst on the crisis gripping the Gulf. Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and others cutting off diplomatic relations with Qatar. We'll figure out how to pronounce it by the end of today's program as well. It's a battle for supremacy with inside a narrow world of Sunni fundamentalist monarchies. Is that the real story? All that and Donald Trump's inconsistent relationship with the Qatari government with Derek Davidson. Plus, Republicans use the Russia crisis to move in the shadows closer and closer to dismantling, destroying healthcare. Why? Because so-called moderates looks like they're getting on board with slashing Medicaid. They are sticking to their core brand proposition. Starve people to give rich people money. And Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions is now moving to the center of the Russia inquiry himself. Will he be called to testify in public? Al Franken says he perjured himself. That looks about right. Theresa May clinging desperately onto power in the UK after great strides by the Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour Party. What's next in the UK and global progressive politics as Bernie Sanders gives a very important speech at the People's Summit in Chicago, which correlates with new research conducted by Stan Greenberg. The Democratic Party does not have a white working class problem. It has a working class problem. That's why things like universal health care are appealing to everybody that isn't rich. And Emmanuel Macron scores big wins in regional elections, but is it his neoliberal agenda or is it his consistent humiliating of Donald Trump? Probably also the fact that he's a fresh face in a sclerotic political scene. Bill Maher gets gently grilled by Michael Eric Dyson and Ice Cube. Watched some of it. It was kind of embarrassing. But he did do a great monologue about Jared Kushner and inequality, which is really what he should stick to. And Megyn Kelly normalizes Alex Jones, while Dana Rohrabacher muses, should we be working with ISIS? And speaking of right-wing politicians that have a newfound respect or interest in collaborating with, at the very least, terrorist sympathizers, Theresa May is going to, if she clings to power, and if the Tories cling to power. Okay. Where would you like me to restart it? Okay, so speaking of conservative sympathy for terrorism, Theresa May, who ran a disgusting campaign along with all of the right-wing tabloids in the UK, calling Jeremy Corbyn a terrorist sympathizer, she is building her continued premiership on an unofficial alliance with a party called the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, a ultra-far-right Northern Irish political party which has connections to vicious Protestant paramilitaries, the equivalent of the, you know, viciousness of the IRA. Now, people have been paying attention a lot to the fact here that they have Stone Age social views. They're like Republicans. They, you know, Earth is 5,000 years old. They hate gay people. They want women to have no sovereignty over their own bodies. But there's another really, really incredible aspect to just how reckless and irresponsible and breathtakingly cynical the massive mediocrity that Theresa May is. And that is that she is willing to jeopardize one of the sort of unequivocal accomplishments of modern UK politics, which started under John Major and was completed under Tony Blair, which is the Northern Irish peace process, which is already threatened by Brexit because the way the borders were designed in the peace agreement could be undermined if they're out of the EU. This is Alistair Campbell on Question Time. He's a former top spin doctor for Tony Blair, no great friend of Jeremy Corbyn, laying out exactly what Theresa May is doing here.
She's playing fast and loose with on Brexit, with Margaret Thatcher's biggest achievement, which was the single market, and now on this with Gordon, with John Major and Tony Blair's greatest achievement, which was the peace process in Northern Ireland. She is putting that at risk with a sordid, disgraceful, dangerous deal.
And I'll just quote really quickly, Jonathan Powell, who helped negotiate, was the former UK chief government negotiator in Northern Ireland, wrote in The Observer, "Since 1990, the British government has been neutral in Northern Ireland, backing neither the unionists nor the nationalists." Powell, who was a former former Prime Minister Tony Blair's chief of staff, writes, "If Mrs. May depends on the DUP to form a government, it will be impossible for her to be even-handed. The other parties in Northern Ireland will know that the unionists can pull the plug at any stage and hold the government hostage." Strong and steady. Strong and steady. Here's something that actually is strong and steady. If you're looking for a Father's Day gift, you already know what it is, and you want to avoid a last-minute hustle of finding a gift, let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how for only $49.99 you can get my limited-time Father's Day package when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter code REPORT in the search bar. That's in the search bar, code REPORT. That's 80% off. For less than $50, you get two filet mignons, top sirloins, chicken fried steaks, boneless pork chops, four burgers, four jumbo franks, a 12-ounce package of all beef meatballs, 1 pound of fries, four caramel apple tartlets, one Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus get four additional burgers free. All of this is less than $50. That's insane. If you're looking for a convenient and quick Father's Day gift, go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code REPORT in the search bar, and add the family pack to your cart and get an 80% savings. Grab your dad and fire up the grill. I have loved every single thing that I've eaten by Omaha Steaks, and my dad is not, he loves the burgers.
I ate the burgers in like consecutive nights.
Have you had the tartlets too?
No, somebody else got the tartlets.
Didn't she get some tartlet last time?
No. Sam took all the tartlets and he probably just shoved them all four in his mouth all at once.
He probably was eating them when he was walking up the street. Yeah. Just like, these are so good.
He loves it.
The tartlets. Hello. I want to talk to you about movement watches. Started by two broke college kids who wanted to wear stylus watches but couldn't afford them. Movement, or MVMT, Movement Watches, was founded in the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. This is really similar to how you launch a podcast like the Majority Report. You start it from the ground up. You have organic growth. You provide a quality service that can be delivered directly to the people. That's what these guys did. By selling their products entirely online, Movement was able to cut out the middleman and retail markup in order to provide you with the best price possible. Watches start at just $95. That's a fraction of what department store brands typically charge. This revolutionary pricing, along with Movement's classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism, has led to over 500,000 watches being sold in over 160 countries. And as we know, Sam scored big when he got his wife Nikki a watch. She loved it, and I keep looking at them myself. I'm just not a watch wearer, but if I ever get converted back to watches, it will definitely be one of these. They look beautiful, and as I say, Sam scored a lot of points. They're a great gift for your significant other or anybody important in your life that wants to up their watch game. So step up your watch game and see why people across the world love Movement watches. Just go to MVMT.com/majority and get 15% off today, plus with free shipping and free returns. MVMT watch, Movement watches make great gifts whenever you're celebrating a graduation or your dad, Father's Day. Hint, hint, Movement's the perfect place to shop. That's MVMT.com/majority. Join the movement. And here's another movement that we're very committed to on the show. Harry's, our old friend Harry's. How are you, Harry? Father's Day is just around the corner, and dads are impossible to shop for. Well, impossible? Not really. Because fortunately, our friends over at Harry's have a special offer that you and your dad are both going to love. Go to harrys.com/majority report and get $5 off of their shave sets, including limited editions Father's Day set, which comes with a Storm Graze razor handle, chrome razor stand, foaming shell, three replacement blades, and a travel cover, and is packaged in a sleek giftable box. I love Harry's. Every time I shave, I use Harry's. It is the perfect razor. I can't really add more to that. Whenever I'm clean shaven, that's because of Harry's. No, Matt loves Harry's. Sam will go into great detail about his nose hairs and the angles and all of that. I don't do that. What? I keep it simple. Harry's is the best shave I ever had.
I love Harry's too.
Kelly loves Harry's too. Everyone loves Harry's. If you have taste, you love Harry's. I got two. I have one that I'm taking up with me to mass when I see my pops.
I just installed a fog-free mirror in my shower, and I used it with my Harry's, and it was very good.
A classed-up operation got over there. You have a little scotch for yourself when you're done?
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, indeed. Go to Carrie.
Good morning.
I could see why you're in such a good mood when we do prep now. Go to harrys.com/majority report right now to redeem a special offer for fans of the show. Harry's will give you $5 off one of their shave sets. This is a limited time only, so act now. That's harrys.com/majority report for $5 off. Help support the Majority Report. Come on, you know what it is. We'll be right back with Derek Davidson on the Majority Report. Back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Derek Davidson. He's a Middle East foreign policy analyst and journalist, and he is returning for his second time on the program. Derek, how you doing?
I'm good, Michael. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to be speaking with you. You're definitely the man that I want to talk to about this crisis in Qatar. First year Arabic coming through. Boom.
Thanks for having me on.
I just had a little lesson during the break. So let's just back up for a minute. Obviously, this kind of, you know, especially in the sort of news cycle we're in now, it almost feels like from a couple of days ago, you know, that this already is almost like, you know, old news in a certain sense. But I want, and even though obviously it isn't, I want to start just by asking you, and we actually have some sound to get to in a bit, but Saudi Arabia broke off relations with Qatar or Qatar. Or what's the third option again?
Qatar.
Qatar. Okay. I think I should stop trying to do that. They broke off relations along with Bahrain, Yemen, and two other Gulf states, United Arab Emirates, and right. accused...
And Egypt.
And Egypt. And they accused Qatar of backing terrorism and of having a secret alliance with Iran. Now, they provided very little evidence for this, but you made the point that there is a history behind this, and this actually goes back to, we think of the regional conflict in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia and Iran, but there's actually a parallel one between these two Gulf monarchies. Can you take us back in time and explain what's the context for this present crisis?
So, I mean, it hasn't been like a huge ongoing thing, but in 1995, I should say, Qatar is, you know, if you look at it on paper, should be pretty closely aligned with Saudi Arabia. They're the only two countries on the planet where Wahhabism is sort of the official state religion.
Can you explain Wahhabism quick for people?
Sure. Well, I mean, this is a whole other show, but
yeah. Well, yeah, of course. But just give them a tiny primer.
It's basically just an ultra conservative,
right.
Islamic fundamentalist revivalism type of school that was founded by a man named Muhammad Saud. An Arabian man, there wasn't a Saudi Arabia at this point, but right. in the 18th century,
right.
named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab.
Right.
And it's a label that applies to people who follow his teachings that was originally coined by the Ottoman Empire as a derogatory thing, and still is seen as derogatory in some circles now, but it's been more accepted.
Okay, so these are basically they're two fundamentalist Gulf kingdoms who are fueled by oil money. So one would think that they would be pretty synchronized, but they're not.
Right, and so what happened in I think we can skip to 1995 if we're talking about Qatar and the Saudis, when the former emir, Sheikh Hamad, overthrew his father in a bloodless coup and took power. Now, his father, the emir before that, Sheikh Khalifa,
mm-hmm.
Had been, you know, well enough liked by the Saudis that they participated the next year in an attempt to get him back on the throne. There was some mercenaries hired, and it was kind of it didn't succeed. It was kind of a comical mess, actually. But they did, you know, participate in this effort to reverse that coup. And so ever since then, there's been sort of this running, not really rivalry. I mean, they're not really in the same weight class mm-hmm. geopolitically, but Qatar has sort of done its own thing in terms of its foreign policy in particular. And that's irritated Riyadh, which, you know, tends to view the Gulf Emirates and most of the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, as it's sort of, you know, fiefdom that, mm-hmm. that these, you know, these countries should fall in line you know, when push comes to shove. And the countries have tried to, you know, for many years they were the only Gulf country that really had any sort of relationship with Israel. They didn't have formal diplomatic ties, but they had some, you know, cordial, at least, relations with Israel. They've supported the Muslim Brotherhood, which the Saudis supported also up until the first Gulf War. They had a falling out over stationing American troops in Saudi Arabia. You know, but the Qataris have consistently supported the Muslim Brotherhood.
I'm sorry, finish your thought, but I did have a follow-up about
well,
that.
Well, yeah, I mean, right. The third thing, which I think is the biggest thing, is they've maintained, again, not, like, close relationships. There's not an alliance or anything like that, but cordial relations with Iran. And that's partly because, you know, Qatar's biggest source of wealth is what's called the North Dome gas field in the Persian Gulf, natural mm-hmm. gas field. Mm-hmm. And that actually is it's big enough that it extends across the Gulf into Iranian waters. So there's a portion of it that's belongs to Iran. And so, you know, the Qataris kind of have to maintain decent relations with Iran because of the pressures of, you know, everybody getting along over this gas field.
But was this accelerated during the Arab uprisings? It seems like the kind of public presentation is that so that the Saudis, on one hand, obviously spread their largesse globally to promote a narrow ideology of Sunni fundamentalism, and that's a problem in foreign policy and in the Saudi presence. But at the same time, specifically with the outbreak, other than in Syria, where obviously they've supported, you know, every type of group imaginable that's trying to dislodge Assad. Besides that, the Saudis' impulse after the Arab uprisings was to try to really preserve the status quo. So contrary to what some people might think, and I know you go even deeper in terms of the falling out with the Muslim Brotherhood going back to the early 90s, but people might generically think, like, oh, okay, in Egypt, the Saudis are going to support Muslim conservatives over secular military, but they don't. They strongly supported and were actually quite angry. That's one of the reasons that the Saudis had a falling out with the Obama administration, that the Obama administration was not supportive enough of maintaining the Mubarak dictatorship, and now they have supported Morsi. The Qataris, on the other hand, have backed the Muslim Brotherhood. They've backed rival groups in Libya. That's another round area where the Saudis and the Qataris are in conflict. And then at the same time, the Qataris, very similarly to the Saudis, while kind of playing, you know, I guess not just footsie, having very close relationships with very fanatic Sunni groups. Some of them right. are definitely terrorist groups. They also, yeah. like the Saudis, they spend, you know, they give money to Brookings. They give money to academic institutions here. And then the third thing that I want you to kind of address, I guess, is the Al Jazeera factor. The Qataris host Al Jazeera, which, you know, is not perfect, but it is a network, certainly in English, that does some very effective journalism, and is some type of voice in the region that is certainly higher quality than obviously any kind of state-run media. That also supposedly made the Saudis angry. But we get to Iran in a second, but those kind of three points of the fallout of status quo versus change in the Arab uprisings, the ways in which the Qataris and the Saudis have the same pattern in terms of just throwing their money, their oil money everywhere so that they can, you know, they be tight with the United States, but also support ISIS and be friendly with Israel, which maybe is another Saudi parallel. And then the Al Jazeera factor.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Arab Spring really kind of freaked the Saudis out quite a bit. And I think we look at Riyadh's foreign policy and it's sort of, you're right. The thing we all always take away is, oh, they spend all this money to support fanatical sort of ultra-conservative Islam all over the world. But historically, that's only been, I mean, that's part of the deal that they sort of have with the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia that the royal family has, is to support these things. But historically, Saudi foreign policy also is very interested in preserving the status quo, because they are the status quo, right? The monarchy is the status quo, and any revolutionary force or something that looks like it might threaten established regimes is always something to be feared. If you go back to the mid-20th century, I mean, you know, we talk about the Saudis in Yemen, you know, sort of opposing these Shia rebels. They backed the Shia monarchy in Yemen against a Republican, you know, revolution that was supported by Egypt in the mid-20th century. So, you know, their ideology has both of these strands. Like, we want to preserve the old guard, you know, in addition to the Wahhabi extremism. And what happened after the Arab Spring, you know, you had a lot of protest movements that morphed into, you know, serious threats to old guard authoritarian regimes, and a lot of them involved the Muslim Brotherhood, particularly, you know, the big example is Egypt, but the Muslim Brotherhood was involved in other places, Tunisia, Syria, Libya, etc. And Qatar, you know, has long had sort of a good relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think the Qataris saw the Arab Spring as an opportunity to back these revolutionary movements. They saw this is the direction the region is going, and we can, you know, we have the resources to support these movements. And when they come to power, they'll, you know, we'll sort of be the godfather of the Arab Spring, and we'll have a lot of influence, and which is something that they've wanted for a long time. They've sort of wanted to have influence on par with their financial resources, as opposed to, you know, on par with their actual size.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's been a big thing. And in 2014, the Saudis orchestrated something like what's happening now. It wasn't to the same level, but they orchestrated, a number of countries cutting off diplomatic ties with the Qataris. And that was specifically over the Qataris' support for the Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt. They just kind of had it. And that, you know, that was about, I think, 8 months that dispute lasted before everybody kind of got back on the same page and normalized relations again. You know, in terms of Syria...
Or it was Al Jazeera. Oh, yeah, no, go ahead, sorry.
Syria. Right, your second point was backing these groups in Syria.
Right, Syria. Go ahead, yeah.
That's kind of, I mean, the Syrian rebellion has shrunk so much now, you know, since Aleppo fell, and, you know, even to go back further, since Russia got into the war and really changed the balance of the situation there, that that's not as active a thing right now. I mean, the Qataris and the Saudis for a couple of years were supporting sometimes the same groups, sometimes different groups. You know, the Qataris in particular, were supporting Jabhat al-Nusra, which has changed its name now several times, but is the Al-Qaeda, Syrian Al-Qaeda branch. The Saudis tried to steer clear of them for a while. It's not clear at this point what that relationship is. But, you know, there were conflicts in Syria. You had groups that were taking Qatari money fighting against groups that were taking Saudi money and sort of battling it out for influence in the overall rebellion. So that's a part of this, you know, sort of underlying problem. I don't think it's one of the immediate causes, because, as I say, that the Syrian rebellion has shrunk down so much that there's not a lot of options for Gulf patrons that want to support rebel groups there. There's not the same sort of plethora of
right.
factions that you can back.
Right.
Al Jazeera is the other piece of this, I think, in addition to, I think that if you wanted to talk about the three main drivers, one would be Qatar's relationship with Iran. The second would be its relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood. And the third would be Al Jazeera. The Gulf countries, in particular the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates, really loathe Al Jazeera because it does, you know, as you say, it's not perfect, and there are questions about its editorial judgment on both the Arabic and, to a lesser extent, the English side when they cover stories that have to do with Qatar.
Right.
But they've reported, you know, the Saudis would say, not objectively. I think the Qataris and Al Jazeera would say they've reported objectively about the other Gulf states. And the Arabic station, which, is probably more the concern here, has really heavily advanced the Muslim Brotherhood point of view.
Right.
They've got a couple of hosts on that channel that are, very strident pro-Muslim Brotherhood people. And, it's just sort of been a constant aggravation for the Saudis and the Emiratis in particular, who have state media, and Al Jazeera is not quite state media. It's,
right.
It's something more independent and has been irritating for them.
Okay, so we have, and we'll get to the Trump and the U.S. dimension because, of course, you know, like the great irony, and not dissimilar from the Saudis, but we have a major base in Qatar and, and of course they're, patrons of Jabhat al-Nusra, which, so there is this sort of odd, truth, I guess, in some of the things that Trump is irresponsibly saying, but we'll get there in a second. Right. I mean, this is a very big move to cut off relations, to kind of impose a blockade. And I just want to play this sound really briefly. This is Qatari Finance Minister Ali Sharif Al-Ahmadi. How am I doing on the pronunciation there, Derek?
That was, you're in the ballpark.
That sounds like Gentleman C. He's talking on CNBC, and he basically is saying that he's not going to, that this is all about dictating Saudi trying to dictate their foreign policy. And I want your comments on it. And then I want you to, pivot, because if this goes as it goes, I mean, is there a possibility here that the Qataris say, all right, fine, forget it. Iran, we're going to escalate from friendly to, positive relations. It's going to be built around that shared natural resource, and, forget our other supposed Gulf brothers. But let's just listen to this for a moment. This is Ahmadi, Qatar's finance minister, on CNBC.
Look at what's happening around us. I think it's a lot to do that they would like to dictate our foreign policy. And everybody knows that Qatar will not allow that somebody will take its, to dictate its foreign policy or to manipulate how their foreign policy should be run.
So they were looking to manipulate.
And I think that was the main reason for whatever the action that they've done.
Now, when we talk about Qatar's relationship with the United States, you have two major U.S. military installations in Qatar, but we've seen some mixed messages from Washington. When you look at what's happening today, would you still say that President Trump is a man that Qatar can do business with?
Well, I think we need to look at the history of the relationship. I think whenever you look at Qatar plus the Western allies, if it was in Europe or if it was in the United States, this is a very long and historic relationship. We're not talking about a president here, or we're talking about a previous administration. We're talking about decades of relationship. And it's been quite a very good relationship in all aspects, if it was military or economically or even social and politically. So, and I think what we're seeing today is a little bit up and down here, but we understand that this is a delicate situation for all the regions in the Gulf, and hopefully that we can come out of this in a much stronger way for Qatar.
We've heard from U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and he was urging calm, while at the same time the president was saying, quote, that Qatar is a high-level sponsor of terror. What do you think he's talking about?
Well, I think if you go back to 1 week, where is the President Trump actually praising Qatar and the GCC and the Arab Islamic Conference, which was in Riyadh, I think, he started his speech by really praising Qatar and becoming Qatar is really an important partner in actually combating terrorism and money laundering in the world. So, and I think the message was very clear from the American administration that we're taking good part in this, and we're working with our allies, with our partner, with our friend, really to combat. This is a very difficult region.
Okay, so there you go. I mean, we'll get, obviously, that opens up the Trump dimension, which I have thoughts on too, but start with the Iran thing, because it seems like that's maybe encoded in the first part of the answer, which is, I mean, we already talked about Muslim Brotherhood in Al Jazeera, but there's the Iran aspect of trying to control their foreign policy. Do they move closer? Like, does the Saudi conspiracy that they have a secret alliance with Iran, which the Saudis have not provided any evidence for, does that become a self-fulfilling prophecy because of what the Saudis are doing?
I mean, I think it could. That would really be, I mean, you know, if you want to talk about a nuclear option, that would be Qatar's nuclear option in this situation. I mean, right. If things really drag on and there's no end in sight and, you know, food starts to run out again or, you know, something really terrible comes of this, could they do that? Yes, they could do that. It would be, there would be no coming back from that. And Qatar, you know, while it has some vulnerabilities with respect to Iran and the, you know, therefore has tried to maintain a friendly relationship with Iran, it's got many, many more vulnerabilities to the, you know, to countries like the Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Bahrain. You know, so I think it would really take something dramatic to get the Qataris to make that, to take that step, because
it, like it actual really is military
a,
action.
A huge. Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, I don't see things escalating in that direction, because even without the Qataris asking, I think a Saudi threat on Qatar that would then, you know, also threaten their shared gas field, I think would draw an Iranian response anyway. I don't think the Qataris would even have to ask for assistance. The Iranians would get involved in that no matter what.
Okay. So then, yeah.
But, you know, the lesser possibility here, the, you know, less than war, I guess, possibility is that the Saudis are trying to orchestrate a coup, which I don't think is out of the realm of possibility. And if something like that were to, you know, if a serious threat like that were to come to light, you know, maybe the Qataris would take the drastic step of, you know, sort of shedding the rest of the Gulf and throwing in with Iran. But again, that would be a really dramatic thing for them to do, and I think they would like to avoid it at all costs.
You know, Derek, you and I have talked about, you know, off air about one of the kind of things that has emerged with Trump is that, you know, in many ways, just like with domestic policy, he is just kind of a grotesque amplification of what already was the consensus, whether it's, you know, Republican, give rich people money and destroy the federal government policy, but also in foreign policy. I mean, in some ways, for all of the kind of weird neo-isolationist ticks and shout-outs to the alt-right, you know, it's kind of been a sort of Rubio-esque foreign policy in many ways. But with this situation, this is an area where it does seem like, you know, probably no other president would be contradicting his Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, who are trying to, you know, issue signals to calm the situation down. And then Trump, as you know, was indicated in an interview, is contradicting Tillerson in tweets. He said just the other day that, you know, and this again, this is where the U.S. has its largest base, and it serves as CENTCOM's forward, you know, headquarters for the region. He called it a funder of terrorism at a very high level. Now, I don't like to adopt Trump speech patterns, but that's kind of true. And, you know, it basically seems that the Saudis, they're savvy enough to take the simplest lesson of all, which is that if Trump comes to your country and you throw a billboard up of him and you give him an amazing necklace and you say, you know, my friend, you're much better than Barack Obama, much better. And your daughter is a total 10. I mean, a 10. It's like, why would there even be a rating scale? Maybe they even offered to behead Melania for him. If you do that, you are going to get loved by Donald Trump. And he will throw a delicate Game of Thrones balance out the window in a second because you're a billionaire, you're royalty, and you treated him well.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's the same. It's the same thing we've seen to some extent in Asia, where he, you know, had his Mar-a-Lago meeting with the president of China, and right, all of a sudden,
great guy,
was basically, you know, getting his policy briefings for East Asia from Beijing.
Right.
It's like
I'm not
that.
Friends, I mean, with Putin anymore. He's not as cool. The Chinese are the new guy. He's cool. That guy's right. So cool. So awesome. I had no idea.
I mean, he's so ignorant of policy and so disinterested in, you know, learning more about it, that he makes these connections with, you know, fellow people of an autocratic mindset or right, fellow billionaires or
right.
I mean, I don't even know if he's a billionaire, but
probably not.
You know, he makes these connections with these people that he has certain things in common with, and, you know, suddenly that's, you know, they're the smart ones. They're the guys that know everything, and he's right, going to listen to these people. And, you know, I do think that's unique. I mean, you wouldn't have another president, I agree, sort of contradicting his cabinet members the way that Trump has been doing. You know, and I just think it's symptomatic of somebody who really latches on to whoever manages to get in his ear and has no way of parsing information that's given to him.
Right. So, I mean, what is the kind of, like, what, I mean, I guess I'm asking you to basically give some kind of sense of a prediction here. Like, what in the U.S., do Tillerson and Mattis take control of the process, or are we just, I mean, maybe we're just in a situation that is the new normal of our foreign policy, which is that you basically could, like, go to a room, you know, you could, someone like Mattis or Tillerson could be mediating and say, like, look, like, the guy's going to send tweets, but whatever. And by the way, if I were you, the Qataris, I would kick some investment into the Trump organization fast, because that might help him think that you're a good guy. but, like, how is this going to, you know, and that's been reported. You know, Jared and Ivanka were traveling there regularly looking for investments in Trump organization things. So, you know, I think there's one thing, like, yes, complete ignorance, total lack of understanding of the world, and all personal affinity for plutocrats and autocrats. But there is always the desire for personal enrichment with these people. So right, that's, you know, that's right, an angle that any, you know, foreign entity can play with this administration. But, you know, do you think that this kind of generally sort of winds down to some degree, or is there something else that's kind of, you know, explosive that we're on the verge of?
I think it'll wind down unless something explosive happens, and I don't.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what that would be. Anything could happen, really.
Well, I guess, is it the coup? I guess that seems to me like the most, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's possible. It's possible. I mean, I don't know that they've, I don't know that that's their goal. I think that they've made some very strong hints that they wouldn't mind if some enterprising member of the Qatari ruling family were to, you know, take matters into his own hands.
Right.
But, you know, I don't have any knowledge of, you know, the Saudis actually pursuing this as an active policy. That would certainly be, you know, that would certainly end things on a very problematic note and probably, you know, escalate tensions in the region even as it sort of solves the Qatari-Saudi problem.
Right.
You know, absent something like that, I think the 2014 spat is instructive here. I mean, I think that, you know, they'll make the Qataris sort of cool their heels for several months, and Qatar will have to make some concessions. They've already started making some concessions around Hamas. They, you know, looks like they're going to kick Hamas out of the country, and you know that's maybe the start of, you know, whatever compromise has to be reached to get everybody back on the same page.
Right.
You know, but anything can happen. I mean, the terrorist attack in Tehran last week isn't directly related to this, but it all feeds into the sort of serious instability in the Persian Gulf right now that could, you know, cause things to go in any number of directions.
Yeah. Syriana's not a bad movie. I feel like it's basically a summary of what you're saying. Derek Davidson, Middle East foreign policy analyst, journalist. Check him out at Low Blog. Check out his website. We'll have links to it all on the majority.fm homepage. Always appreciate your time, Derek. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Michael.
Take care. All right, everybody. We are going to head to the fun half. We've got so much for you. The Republicans are moving on destroying your health care to fund their tax giveaways. Bernie Sanders maps it out. There's some people on Twitter have very utterly bizarre fixations on Bernie Sanders. I've always been willing to critique Bernie when he's off. Going back into the primary, we were a show that supported Bernie Sanders, but generally supported the Black Lives Matter protesters protesting him and said rightly that it would make him a better candidate. But people who actually don't like Bernie Sanders, you're either living out 2016 primary propaganda from a failed candidate,
or you need to unfollow Peter Dow, basically.
Yeah, or what? I don't know. Like, or you should just, you know, you're not progressive. You don't think everyone should have health care. You know, like and then at the very least, then make it, you know, do third way Twitter. But this constant onslaught and like this idea Bernie Sanders should go away. Bernie Sanders is the most popular politician in the country. And a difference between him and many other politicians is that his popularity actually increased with more exposure. Most politicians, the more you get to know them, people don't like them. So it's just utterly and go away to make way for who? Who are these other magnificent Democratic leaders that you're talking about? I mean,
and it's not like I think Bernie's generally pretty good about not feeding into his own personality cult, because I mean, I watched his People Summit speech a number of times. The crowd started chanting Bernie, Bernie, and he's like, no, it's not Bernie. It's about you.
It's about you. I mean, the guy's been saying the same thing for decades. And while a lot of people that are somehow retroactively woke or progressive in this bizarre reading, obviously starting with the Clintons, were doing everything they could to accommodate Wall Street, did nothing about income inequality except increase it, expanded the prison industrial complex. He was there voting against welfare reform, talking about income inequality, calling himself a democratic socialist when that was, you know, you might as well said you were a follower of Lyndon LaRouche. And what, he had the temerity of running like a gentle issue-based campaign against Hillary Clinton? And let me be really honest. Like, look, if you were running a real campaign to win that primary, it would have been significantly tougher. Significantly tougher. It's a bizarre and weird fixation. And if whenever people have legitimate critiques of Bernie, I'm into it because I don't like nobody's above reproach. But this idea that the most popular politician in the country, who is a ceaseless advocate for the most underlooked and now generation-defining issues we face, should go away.
To be fair, those people are under a lot of pressure the last week with Corbyn's victory.
Yeah.
It's defensiveness.
Yeah, I guess so. Would you vote for Theresa May or Jeremy Corbyn? And, you know, because some of these are just divisions. I mean, some people are more excited by Emmanuel Macron than Jeremy Corbyn. And that's simple. You're a neoliberal centrist. I'm progressive. I'm left. That's great. Let's have a dispute. But don't write some fucking nonsense about, you know, still with this Bernie is sexist. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's embarrassing. All right. We got to get to the fun half. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Support the show, become a member, subscribe to our YouTube channel, like us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. See you in the fun half. I am Zoran.
Up to